Upon arrival at the hospital, the doctor found that he is already dead.
A member of North Korea's ruling Kim family is dead. It's Wednesday, February 15th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Log on now for a greater program experience on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, North Korea continues nuclear ambitions, a close encounter of the airplane kind with China. Indonesia refugees seek travel to the United States. The Korea Olympics are soon. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The older half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un was assassinated Monday at an airport in Malaysia, according to a Malaysian police official. Intelligence sources in Washington say there is a strong belief the killing was ordered by Kim Jong-un in Pyongyang. The National Intelligence Service in Seoul tells VOA's Korean service it could neither confirm nor deny that scenario. Kim Jong-nam fell ill at Kuala Lumpur International Airport. Police official Fadzil Ahmad said Kim mentioned he felt like someone grabbed or held his face from behind. The possible suspect is a woman who is carrying a cloth allegedly treated with a lethal liquid. Kim was taken to an airport clinic and a decision was made shortly thereafter to transport him to a hospital. Kim Jong-nam apparently died en route. District Police Chief Abdul Aziz Ali described to VOA Korean reporter Jenny Lee what happened.
There's one Korean guy which is about to board a plane. Destination is for Macau at around 10:30. The flight is supposed to be at 10:30. So at around 9 when he was at the airport, he complained that he's not well, he's sick, complained to the officials at the airport. So the officials there took him to the clinic. At the airport, KLIA, there's a clinic there. Mm-hmm. So we took him to the clinic, and the doctor at the clinic referred him to the hospital nearby. So upon arrival at the hospital, the doctor found that he is already dead. Probably on the way to the hospital, the person died.
Earlier reports said Kim Jong-un was pricked with poison needles by two North Korean female agents who fled the scene in a taxi. Until laboratory tests are completed, Ali said the cause of death remains uncertain. The police chief said no one has been apprehended in connection with the death. Kim Jong-nam was estranged from North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-nam was once considered the heir apparent to lead North Korea, but he fell out of favor with their father, the late dictator Kim Jong-il, after a failed 2001 attempt to enter Japan on a forged passport to visit Disneyland. Since then, Kim Jong-nam has lived in virtual exile, primarily in the Chinese territory of Macau. Kim Jong-un assumed leadership of North Korea when Kim Jong-il died in 2011, and since taking power, Kim Jong-un has executed or expelled numerous high-level government officials. They included the killing of his uncle, who was once considered the second most powerful man in North Korea. We invite you to read more on our top story by following our Facebook page, VOA Asia, and also the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. North Korean leader believed to have ordered assassination of half-brother. China's Xi says officials should prevent abuse of power. South Korean far-right rises up to defend impeached president. Hopes fade for Cambodia winning U.S. debt relief, analysts say. Recent Trump win on China trademark raises ethics questions. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our website, voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. South Korea says North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is focusing on boosting his country's nuclear and missile capabilities while seeking to consolidate his base power. The Unification Ministry said ahead of this week's 75th birthday of Kim's late father, Kim Jong-il, the regime is strengthening its reign of terror, and it expects purges to continue and rights abuses to worsen. Tufts University Korea specialist Sung Yoon Lee tells VOA's Victor Beatty he doubts this latest UN statement will alter the North's behavior.
Any kind of rhetorical condemnation coming out of the UN Security Council or General Assembly doesn't have any kind of bite. It is not an enforceable measure. It is more a symbolic condemnation, which has no impact on North Korean behavior. Even statements coming out of Beijing or Seoul or Tokyo or Washington in the past, when people said this is absolutely unacceptable, it's a serious provocation, there will be serious consequences, have had no deterrent effect on North Korea. So the latest provocation by North Korea is more a riposte, a jab, instead of a hook, a knockout blow against the Trump administration to condition the Trump administration to put up with this kind of provocation, defiance, and blatant violation of several UN Security Council resolutions.
At a Washington news conference with Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, President Trump described the North as a, quote, big, big problem, and vowed, quote again, we will deal with that very strongly.
I hope so. North Korea is indeed an imminent threat, a lethal, growing lethal threat to U.S. security and the security of its allies in the region. So to continue to sort of try to sweep the North Korea problem under the rug and hope for the best, hope that China will rein North Korea in, as previous U.S. administrations have done, that is not a good policy.
He said the North has made steady strides in its nuclear and missile programs, and the international community has been ineffective in its response. Sung-Yun Lee said it's time to go after the North's vulnerabilities, including its dependency on dollar-generated illicit activities. Yonhap said the missile launched Sunday had a range of over 2,000 kilometers, and RAND Corporation Korea analyst Bruce Bennett says this missile used for the first time solid fuel propellant.
That's important because that makes a missile much easier to launch quickly. And the launcher that they showed it on had tracks as opposed to wheels. Most of the roads in North Korea aren't paved. They're still dirt and gravel roads. So it's kind of hard with a heavy missile launcher to run over those roads. But if it's tracked, then it can handle those roads and move a lot of places that a wheeled launcher can't. This is an important missile development that is a little surprising. I haven't heard for sure whether it was really a fully successful launch, but it certainly was fairly successful.
From what you know, where are they with regard to an intercontinental ballistic missile?
Well, the interesting question is whether the base of this missile is actually the second stage of an ICBM. So this may have been part of an ICBM that they were testing in terms of a launch. We really don't know at this stage. But, you know, this is way too short a range, this missile, for an ICBM itself. It could be part of an ICBM. And we haven't seen the rest of the ICBM in terms of a launch yet, so it's hard to tell where they are in that process.
Bruce Bennett said the North may now be capable of launching without notice a nuclear-tipped missile that, even if landing in ocean waters, could damage or destroy shipping, or if detonated in the atmosphere, could cause an electromagnetic pulse, interrupting aircraft and shipping computers. Happening now in Asia, nominations open Tuesday for Hong Kong's top and possibly most difficult job, chief executive. Hong Kong voters will go to the polls March 26th to select the city's next leader from among 1,200 candidates. Critics say the real choice is made in Beijing. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Last week, two U.S. defense officials described an unsafe, close encounter between a U.S. Navy P-3 Orion aircraft and a Chinese surveillance aircraft. The two planes flew within 300 meters of each other in the general vicinity of the contested Scarborough Shoal in the South China Sea. VOA Mandarin reporter Li Bao has more as Lori London narrates.
In a statement to VOA, the U.S. Pacific Command said the United States would address the issue through diplomatic and military channels. A Chinese official publication reporting that Beijing said its pilot had acted legally and professionally. It's unclear if the PLA pilot deliberately flew just 300 meters from the U.S. plane. However, Tom Monken, president of Washington-based think tank CSBA, tells VOA that operating very close to U.S. forces is a clear PLA tactic to influence Washington's determination in maintaining a robust presence in the Western Pacific.
It's part of a pattern of behavior that's designed to raise the risk on our side and make us less willing to operate in international airspace, just as other actions have been targeted to make us less willing to operate in international waters.
The U.S. and China have signed a code of conduct for air encounters. The U.S. Navy commanders have said the agreement works despite occasional unsafe close encounters. Monken, who served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, said the agreement is valuable in other important ways.
The main value of an agreement like that is that it can help us distinguish between those two types of actions that I said at the outset, right? So it can help us distinguish between what is truly an accident, unplanned, unprofessional, and what is meant to be a deliberate act and a deliberate signal. And I think that in and of itself is very valuable.
Many defense experts say the U.S. military has been too risk-averse as China builds islands and installs military facilities in the South China Sea. That may result in even bigger risk in the future, argues Monken, as he presented his organization's new report on the U.S. military's Asia-Pacific strategy on Friday.
And I think one of the dangers of acting so risk-averse is that competitors can misjudge us. They can believe that we really don't care about something that in the end we wind up caring about.
For Li Bao, I'm Lori London.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on the Voice of America.
Developing at this hour in Asia, air pollution in Asia is believed to have contributed to 2.2 million deaths in China and India alone. A new study by the U.S.-based Health Effects Institute also indicates 92% of the world's population lives in areas with unhealthy air. VOA keeps you informed all day on Facebook, where you'll find Steve Miller's Asia in a Minute. VOA Asia continues. U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to block entry to the United States for citizens of seven Muslim-majority nations has sparked a backlash and legal challengers. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld an injunction that halted the president's executive order that also includes a 120-day suspension of all refugee resettlement in the United States. VOA Asia's Steve Miller spoke with reporter Krithika Varagur in Jakarta about how these events have affected the 14,000 refugees and asylum seekers in Indonesia.
If we take a look at Indonesia's refugee and asylum-seeking populations, could you give us an idea of what the breakdown in the demographics are?
Definitely the number one population of both refugees and asylum seekers is Afghan Hazaras. They're about 50% of both refugees and asylum seekers. And then about another 30% comes from a combination of Rohingya refugees and from Myanmar and East African refugees, largely from Somalia.
Now, from what I understand, there's also a relatively significant portion of the population that is also from Iran.
They're not huge in numbers, but they do have a fairly large cultural presence here in Jakarta.
And how have they adapted to life in Indonesia coming from Iran?
One thing that's unique about Iranian refugees is they're not necessarily fleeing conflict or war per se. They're fleeing persecution. And quite a few of them here are Christians. Either they fled Iran because they were being persecuted for Christianity, or they have converted to Christianity here. So they have started a community church in North Jakarta by and for Persian refugees. It's a Farsi service, and it's become a real tentpole of the refugee community here in Jakarta.
Now, among those in Indonesia who happen to be refugees or seeking asylum. What's been the overall reaction to not only President Trump's executive order, but also the actions by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to enjoin that order?
So there was obviously widespread panic in the immediate wake of the executive order because America is the number one destination for resettlement from refugees in Indonesia. And then with the kind of up-in-the-air feeling of the court's opposition to the executive order, a lot of people are basically holding their breath and not trying to count their chickens before they hatch, so to speak. As far as they're concerned, it's still quite an unstable situation in terms of resettling any refugees to America. They're not getting their hopes up, and they're trying to figure out how to move on from here.
In your discussions with not only refugees and asylum seekers, but with organizers who are assisting them, what's been the greatest challenge those individuals have faced?
Well, Indonesia is enormously backlogged as it is, and they're concerned about that backlog increasing. There are 14,000 refugees and asylum seekers here, but only a few hundred every year get resettled because every country in the world is really making cuts in its refugee policy now. Australia was the biggest destination, and then they stopped accepting maritime refugees altogether. Of course, Western Europe has reached capacity and is closing its borders left, right, and center. America was really the biggest outlet for that. And if the refugee ban becomes a reality, right now it's only there for 120 days, that will seriously almost grind the resettlement process here to a halt.
Has the entire process altered their view of the United States in any way?
The sense I got from talking to a lot of refugees is that they really are distressed by Trump's ban, but the reason that they want to go to America are still largely intact. They see it as a land of opportunity and a really desirable place to end up to make something of their future.
Krithika Varagor is in Jakarta. She reports for us from that location. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for speaking with me. It's great to be here.
Developing at this hour in Asia, India's space agency will attempt to launch 104 satellites from a single rocket Wednesday, a record that, if successful, will affirm India's space abilities after its successful Mars orbiter mission. The launch would almost triple the current record of 37 satellites Russia sent into the orbit in 2014. VOA Asia keeps you informed on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia. South Korea has begun its one-year countdown to the 2018 Pyeongchang Winter Olympics, and North Korea remains silent about whether it will take part in the Games. The head of the Winter Games Organizing Committee, Lee Hee-bum, said ahead of a celebrity-packed countdown ceremony that anyone who loves peace can participate, even North Korea. He added that he doesn't believe tensions are increasing right now on the Korean Peninsula. However, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un began 2017 by boasting about his ballistic missile program after a series of missile and nuclear tests the previous year. The Pyeongchang Games will mark 30 years since South Korea hosted its first Olympics, the 1988 Summer Games in Seoul. North Korea boycotted the event, but has warmed in recent years to participating in international competitions in South Korea. Michael Madden, a visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, U.S.-Korea Institute, said there is no question North Korea will compete in Pyeongchang.
North Korea will certainly stoke a kind of a teasing with whether they're going to send somebody to the, you know, the dreaded South for the games. But they're going to definitely, I mean, they field teams to the Winter Olympic Games, and they're going to do that.
Madden noted the North took a similar approach ahead of the 2014 Asian Games in Incheon, South Korea, before sending its athletes. All of the Winter Olympic venues are located within Gangwon Province, which remains divided along the demilitarized zone that was established at the end of the Korean War. Compared to many places in South Korea, Madden said the citizens in the southern half of Gangwon Province typically
support a more dovish policy from the South Korean government towards the North.
Since South Korea won its bid in 2011 to host the Winter Games, North Korea has hinted at jointly hosting sporting events for the 2018 Games. Pyeongchang's organizing committee and the International Olympic Committee have shut down the idea, citing the IOC charter. Gangwon Province Governor Choi Moon-soon told VOA the people of Gangwon are still deeply wounded by the split of their province. They hope for unification, and not just for the separated families, but for the development of Gangwon Province. If there was ever a slim hope of a jointly hosted Winter Games, Madden said it got discarded with the political scandal that has ensnared President Park Geun-hye.
If they had a president, they had a popular president that was active in office, then we might be having a different conversation.
South Korea is now led by an interim government under acting president and prime minister Hwang Kyo-an. He spoke at the countdown ceremony about a number of adversities South Korea has faced to successfully prepare for the games, but he did not give specifics. Be sure you check out this week's VOA Game Room podcast for more on the one-year countdown to the Winter Olympics in South Korea. Of course, we're going to be following it all the way through the games. We'd like to say a special hello to our listeners in Myanmar who are listening via Facebook on VOA Burmese. Thank you so much for joining us today. And also, when you have a chance, stop by Twitter. You can follow me at VOA Stevenson. This has been VOA Asia. We're on Facebook by that very same name, VOA Asia. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jimmy Cook, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Steve Miller, Ali Ogden, and our great interns Eli Zimmerman and An Ying. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Central Command and Central Special Operations Command are at the very center of the U.S. fight against terrorism. Those serving at CENTCOM have bravely fought across the theater of war in the Middle East and bravely battled a vicious enemy that has no respect for human life, said President Donald Trump in a recent speech to the Central Command. He expressed the nation's gratitude to all serving overseas, including all of U.S. military personnel in Afghanistan. United States Special Operations Command has dispatched its legendary warriors to the most secret, sensitive, and daring missions in defense of the United States of America. No enemy, said President Trump, stands a chance against our special forces. The president noted that even though U.S. forces are well-trained and well-prepared, ISIS presents a very large challenge. We're up against an enemy that celebrates death and totally worships destruction, said President Trump. ISIS is on a campaign of genocide, committing atrocities across the world. Radical Islamic terrorists are determined to strike our homeland, as they did on 9/11, as they did from Boston to Orlando to San Bernardino. Europe also has suffered catastrophic terrorist attacks in Paris, Nice, Brussels, and Berlin. The United States is delivering a message in a unified voice, said President Trump. To these forces of death and destruction, America and its allies will defeat you. We will defeat them. We will defeat radical Islamic terrorism, and we will not allow it to take root in our country.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.